This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Africa marks a big milestone in the pandemic. The first vaccine produced there is shipping out across the continent.
When African countries came together, we said we will buy vaccines and we will buy them with our own money.
Also today, the island nation of Madagascar is in a historic drought. Crops are failing. People are hungry. Experts tell us this is what a world impacted by climate change looks like.
Normally, you would see flowing rivers, gushing streams. This is cracked sand earth.
And in China, a hot new swimming trend.
Actually, the whole body has to get into the movement. It's very good for relaxation.
And who doesn't need that? I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to be with you. We begin today with the story of 24-year-old Tong Ying Kit. He was a waiter and a cook in a Hong Kong restaurant. That was before he hopped on his motorcycle last year and unfurled a protest banner. He then crashed into some Hong Kong police and injured three officers. Today, Tong Ying Kit has become the first person to be tried under a new Hong Kong national security law. The court has found him guilty of terrorism and inciting secession. Chris Young has been following the case closely. He's the former chair of the Hong Kong Journalists Association. He joins us from Hong Kong. Tell us more, if you would, Chris, about Tong Ying Kit. Who is he and what exactly has he been convicted of?
He drove a motorbike on July 1st last year, the first day of the implementation of the national security law. He was arrested and then taken to court. His lawyer will seek leniency on Thursday, and then after that, the court will deliver the sentencing, which will be no doubt quite severe because court will also be under pressure to give a heavy, harsh sentence to deter similar acts.
What was the reasoning behind the verdict? How did the judges explain it?
He drove a motorbike with a banner, Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Times. That's the day when there were still protesters in streets, and he ran into policemen. So that's why the Terrorist Act charge. But then more severely, that slogan has now been accepted by the judges that it has the meaning of independence from China. That was the crux of the argument during the 15-day trial. Both sides got expressed opinion from academics, basically. The prosecution, citing Chinese historical texts, argued that that slogan is subversive. But then the other side, the defense lawyers, argued that slogan has different meaning to different people. And a slogan is a slogan. And right. That did not necessarily mean that Tong was seeking or advocating independence from China. But now the judges basically accept the view that merely hoisting slogans like this could carry the meaning of independence. And that will have profound and bad implication on freedom of expression in Hong Kong.
Your point is well taken. A lot of the discussion on this case is centered on that slogan, Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times, which suggests to the judges that this was a call for independence from China, which obviously is banned under the law. All three of the judges in this trial were handpicked by Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam. Was this a fair trial?
The judgment is not convincing, but not surprising, because I think that under the provisions in the law, I think the room for judges to apply common law and apply the standard, the benchmark of freedoms in Hong Kong when adjudicating such cases is extremely limited. And I think that's the crux of the problem we are facing now.
Well, some 60 other Hong Kong residents are awaiting trial on charges brought under the national security law. What are they thinking right now?
The way the judges interpret slogans and acts do not bode well, basically, on all national security law cases, including the 12 and maybe some other who face the Apple Daily case, I mean, Jimmy Lai case.
The Apple Daily newspaper, right. So it's interesting as well, Tong Ying Kit was denied bail and there was no jury. I mean, is that what we can expect with these other trials?
Most, if not all, cases of people arrested for national security law are denied bail. So effectively, have already lost their freedom the first day they were arrested.
It's not clear when the court will hand down Tong Ying Kit's sentence. What sort of sentence is he likely to get?
Under the law, the maximum sentence is life imprisonment. The kind of minimum will be something like 10 years in jail. No, it's difficult to tell because there's no precedent, but it won't be a lenient one.
So this was the first case of a violation of Hong Kong's new security law. Now that there is a verdict, how will pro-democracy activists regulate themselves? I mean, we know what the law is, but now that it's played out with a defendant, will it have a chilling effect?
The chilling effect has already been felt. The media, the film industry, and even perhaps the general public. And that's one of the important reasons behind the migration in recent months. The opposition or so-called democratic camp is already in tatters. Many key figures are either in jail or facing charges. And then now the whole civil society is facing the risk. And those who are in the vulnerable sectors like media publications will feel more worried.
Chris Young is the former chair of the Hong Kong Journalists Association. He's been speaking with us from Hong Kong. Thank you very much, Chris.
Okay, you're welcome.
Should medical workers be required to get vaccinated? The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs yesterday announced it's making coronavirus vaccines compulsory for frontline workers. Other medical groups in the U.S. are talking about doing the same. Meanwhile, in Europe, several countries are already requiring shots for their medical personnel. As the world's Lydia Manalido reports from Athens, not everyone is on board.
In downtown Athens today, a small but fiery group of healthcare workers gather in the shadow of the building that houses the Greek Ministry of Health. They've been coming out for days now, sometimes in crowds of thousands. Savrula Agelidou is a nurse in the kidney unit at a hospital here in town. She says their message is simple. We're pro-vaccine, but against making it compulsory, she tells me. But that's exactly what Greece is doing. Following in the footsteps of Italy and France, Greece is now requiring all healthcare workers, doctors, paramedics, administrative staff, to get vaccinated by September 1st. If they don't, they won't be allowed to work and won't get paid. We will not let this happen, says Michalis Giannakos. He is the president of a group that represents public hospital employees. He says most healthcare workers, including the people here, are vaccinated already. He says the Greek government should be using scientific arguments to convince those who have been holding out because of health issues or lingering concerns about the vaccine. But Greek authorities and supporters of the new measures say it's about time for all frontline health workers to get vaccinated. COVID cases in the country, like in much of Europe and around the world, are surging as the more transmissible Delta variant spreads. The daily infection rate in Greece more than doubled this month, and some scientists predict infections will peak in the first half of August. Giannakos, though, worries mandatory vaccinations will be counterproductive. He says this could lead to staff shortages, and the healthcare system is already under a huge amount of stress. He's also worried that mandatory vaccines will fan the fanaticism of anti-vaxxers and undermine public confidence. This last point about public trust is one that at least one European leader has used to argue against the measure. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said earlier this month that Germany's focus will be on education, not mandates, because the latter could hurt public trust. Merkel made the comments after France announced it was requiring healthcare workers to get the jab. Thousands of people in France have been protesting this and other measures, saying these mandates infringe on personal freedoms. Meanwhile, several other European countries are moving in the same direction. Hungary, for example, says it's making vaccines for all healthcare staff obligatory. Belgium is reportedly considering the move, and Poland says it's also mulling it over. For The World, I'm Lydia Manulidou in Athens.
In Russia, there's a green light for a new vaccine trial. The idea is to combine a first dose of the Russian vaccine, Sputnik V, with a second dose of the British AstraZeneca shot. Russia still has a lot of jabs left to give. Only about 20% of Russians have been vaccinated, with vaccine hesitancy high across Russia. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Judy Twigg. She's a global public health expert at Virginia Commonwealth University. And in fact, Judy, your specialty in public health is Russia and Eurasia. Before we talk about this new vaccine cocktail the Russians are going to be trialing, generally, what is the current state of the pandemic in Russia?
They've been hit pretty hard with the Delta variant, so caseloads and deaths from COVID-19 have increased significantly over the last month to 6 weeks. Vaccine rates are incredibly low. Opinion polls show somewhere between 50% and 60% of the population says they will not get vaccinated under any circumstances. When this new wave of the Delta variant hit about 6 weeks ago, the government started to take some more proactive measures in trying to get people vaccinated. And yet they still seem to be roughly around a ceiling of about a quarter of people with at least one shot and only about 16% of people that have had both doses.
So that's the background, Judy, for this trial that will start with a first dose of Sputnik V followed by a second dose of AstraZeneca. What are health experts in Russia hoping to learn?
Obviously, they're hoping to learn some science. The AstraZeneca vaccine and the Sputnik V vaccine are based on the same adenoviral platform. So it's an interesting piece of science to see how these two vaccines that are tweaks, basically, of a very similar vaccine work together. It's a relatively small trial, but it's significant in that it's the first Western vaccine that will be, at least legally, administered on Russian soil. To me, what's significant about this trial is that it is an effort to increase the legitimacy of the Sputnik V vaccine. The Sputnik V vaccine was the first one in the world to be approved by any national regulatory authority back in August of last year. The Russians rolled it out a little too quickly, made a lot of premature claims about its safety and efficacy, and they've been playing catch up ever since then, trying to convince people that this is a safe and effective vaccine, which it looks like it is, but they, I think, gain an extra aura of credibility when they're working together with a respected Western vaccine like AstraZeneca.
So you mentioned the adenovirus platform. That's what both these vaccines are based on. Neither of them use the mRNA technology. So how might mixing these two vaccines improve efficacy and help people?
Even though they're both based on an adenoviral platform, they're still coming at the virus in slightly different ways. You know, they're using slightly different techniques to teach the immune system how to fight off the virus. And so we're hoping to learn more about how that works by combining these two vaccines together.
So, Judy, you mentioned earlier that authorities in Russia have tried requiring vaccinations for public service sector workers, some restaurants and cafes insisting on vaccine proof. What else can be done? Because this is not just a problem in Russia. The U.S. is right behind Russia in terms of global vaccine hesitancy.
There are many different tactics, I think, that need to be put into place because the vaccine hesitant population in the United States, in Russia, anywhere, isn't monolithic. There are many different reasons that different groups of people have for being hesitant to take the vaccines. Some of them will sound familiar to anyone following vaccine hesitancy in the United States and Western Europe and other places in the world. There's a distrust of authority. There are plenty of conspiracy theories about the vaccine. I think in Russia, a large part of it will be just standard tools that we've had in place for decades to try to overcome vaccine hesitancy, finding out who the influencers are at the community level. And here we're getting down into individual communities, churches, mosques, neighborhoods, workplaces, social media nodes, and finding out who the people are that have the capacity to influence large numbers of the folks in their networks and making sure that the right kind of scientifically grounded messages get out through those influencers.
Judy Twigg is a global public health expert at Virginia Commonwealth University, speaking with us about a new vaccine trial in Russia combining Sputnik V and a second dose of Oxford's AstraZeneca. Judy, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. As the Biden administration struggles to cope with an influx of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, it's announcing a big shift in immigration policy. Asylum cases can now be fast-tracked at the border after an initial screening. Asylum seekers who do not qualify for entry can be swiftly sent away. The policy is known as expedited removal. Randy Capps has been following this. He's the director of research with U.S. programs at the Migration Policy Institute in Washington. Explain the basics of expedited removal, Randy, if you would. Who exactly will it apply to?
Expedited removal is another form or procedure that the Border Patrol can use to sometimes bypass the immigration courts. It means that the presumption is that that individual who was arrested by the Border Patrol doesn't go before an immigration judge, but instead can be fast-tracked deported. Expedited removal does, however, still allow someone to claim asylum, and when they do so, then they get an initial interview with a USCIS asylum officer.
So just to be clear, is this forced removal? And if it is, where are these individuals or families sent? Back to their home countries?
It is forced removal only if they don't have a valid asylum claim, and that's a pretty low bar. So most of them will pass that.
Why does the Biden administration want to use this policy? What problem do they say it solves?
Well, they've been accused of catch and release, which is the phrase that people who want stricter border control use when describing this process of giving them basically a piece of paper to go into the immigration court process and then letting them loose in the United States. And I think what the Biden administration's attempting to do is to make the process a little bit more controlled, ensuring that they can get that family through at least the initial stages in a much more controlled setting.
Expedited removal does sound like it'll make things easier for administration at the border, but lawyers and immigration advocates must see this differently.
Well, from an immigration advocate or defense attorney point of view, the essential thing is that whether they're an individual or a family, get that right to apply for asylum. And everything that I've read from what the Biden administration's put forward suggests that that will be the case.
Right. So explain briefly how the legal constraints and kind of calendar, the time restrictions are actually changing.
The big change here is procedural. It's that the procedure would not be to go into that immigration court backlog first. It would be to go through the asylum office first, with the understanding that a broader core of asylum officers can handle the cases more quickly.
So just to be clear, I mean, this has been tried, expedited removal has been tried before by both Democrat and Republican administrations. How has it worked in the past?
Most of the time, it's actually been used for adults, not families, and for people who are unlikely to claim asylum. And in those cases, it's very speedy. There's no immigration court involvement. It's a matter of days and sometimes hours. You know, using it for families and asylum seekers has always been tricky because you've got to bring in that extra step of the asylum claim and the USCIS officer. And the other thing is you can't by law detain a family for very long. So that first part of the process has to be done very quickly if you want that family to be in detention, or you have to find another setting where you can do that initial credible fear interview with the USCIS asylum officer.
That's Randy Capps in Washington. He's the director of research for U.S. programs at the Migration Policy Institute. Randy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
When it comes to young immigrants in the U.S., we hear a lot about DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The Obama-era program protects certain undocumented people in the U.S. from deportation. Another group of young people who arrived with their parents on work visas also face uncertainty because of a growing visa backlog. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval spoke with one family about what's at stake for them.
Animesh Namjoshi types notes in his online economics class, one of his last courses at the University of Texas at Austin. In a matter of weeks, Namjoshi plans to graduate with a degree in economics. For most, it's an exciting time. but for him,
graduation means that my time is running out, ironically, so it's definitely not a happy thing.
Namjoshi's student visa will expire when he graduates, but his immigration issues started long before that. He and his parents left their home country of India when Namjoshi was a toddler and came to the U.S. when Namjoshi was just 10 years old. They now live in Katy near Houston.
My dad came as a high-skilled worker. He's an instrumentation engineer in the oil and gas industry, so my family came to Houston with him.
With his dad's work visa, the family applied for a green card, which would give them a path to citizenship. But because of the way green cards are distributed with specific country caps, people from India face long backlogs. Here's Namjoshi's dad, Jayanth, who says it will take decades before he'll get his green card.
Mine was filed in 2012. With no bill passing, it would take another 30 years for me.
Jayanth is still protected by the work visa he came on. But if he quits his job before those 30 years, he'll also be forced to leave. And he says he'll likely leave earlier if nothing happens to speed up the green card backlog.
If nothing happens in 5 years, I'm just going to leave the country. Leave it. I mean, I'm frustrated, utterly frustrated.
But his son, Animesh Namjoshi, may have to leave right away. That's because when he turned 21, he aged out of his dad's work visa protections and green card eligibility. His student visa was the only thing that allowed him to stay. When he graduates, those protections end. He joins other young immigrants who face a similar fate. They came legally to the U.S. as kids under their parents' work visa, but as adults are no longer eligible to stay in the U.S. unless Congress takes action. The issue springs from the growing green card backlog for families, many from India, who came to the U.S. for jobs.
The U.S. is the country that I've known the longest, and yet I'm in danger of having to leave.
Immigration advocates estimate at least 200,000 people are confronting the same problem, aging out of visa protections. Deep Patel founded Improve the Dream, a national advocacy group, and says 4 years ago, this issue wasn't on lawmakers' radar. But now,
along the way, there's been some good successes.
Patel says kids of these high-skilled workers were included in the Dream and Promise Act, legislation that passed the House in March and was created to protect undocumented DACA recipients.
I don't see us as being different. Any child who grew up here, whether it was with a documented status or an undocumented status, deserves to stay.
The bill faces Republican opposition, though Patel says there's a chance protections could also come while passing the 2022 budget. I asked him if he's discouraged looking at how long DACA recipients have fought, still with no permanent solution. He says, on the contrary,
the next 6 to 12 months are probably the most hopeful that I think I've been, because it seems like there are multiple avenues that are possible.
Patel may be hopeful, but Animesh Namjoshi is concerned about what's going to happen next if he's unable to find a work or student visa to remain in the U.S. with his parents and little brother.
I have a younger brother. We're pretty close, and I'll have to separate from my parents and my brother.
And he says if this issue isn't solved in the next decade, his younger brother will face a similar fate. For The World, I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
You're with The World. Russia is now blocking websites associated with opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who accuses the government of poisoning him. His supporters shrug it off.
I mean, we've already passed the chemical warfare stage. So at this point, blocking websites seems pretty mild.
The View from Moscow, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Almost 2 months after a runoff election, Peru gets a new president tomorrow. Pedro Castillo, a rural school teacher, will wear Peru's red and white presidential sash and take the oath of office. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports.
Peru is politically divided. You could see that a few days ago when members from the two leading parties in Congress faced off on national television.
Actual congresista de la República, Carlos Mejía. Muy buenas noches, gracias por acompañarnos.
Congressman Carlos Mejía is with the right-wing Fuerza Popular, the main opposition party.
Congresista Chávez, muy buenas noches, gracias por estar con nosotros.
¿Cómo estás, Cristian? ¿Qué tal? ¿Cómo está el colega?
And Congresswoman Betsy Chavez is a member of the leftist Perú Libre, which is the president's party. Chavez and Mesía debated president-elect Pedro Castillo's biggest and most controversial proposal, rewriting Peru's constitution.
No debemos dejar que el tema de la constitución solamente se resuelva en el monopolio del Congreso.
Chavez said Congress shouldn't change the new constitution without input from farmers and indigenous groups. Mesía sees it differently.
Tiene que partir de un punto de vista que la Asamblea Constituyente es una ruptura de la legalidad.
Mesía said altogether, rewriting Peru's constitution would be illegal.
Well, Peruvian politics is very hard to predict.
Rodrigo Barrenechea is a political scientist in Lima.
And my area of specialization is populism.
Barrenechea specializes in populism across the Andes. President-elect Castillo's challenges to writing a new constitution are the same he'll face in governing, a divided Congress led by an assertive opposition. That's even though Castillo rose to power on a populist wave against political and economic elites in the capital of Lima. Barrenechea says Castillo's strength as an outside candidate will be a vulnerability as president.
He comes from outside the usual circles of political, economic, and social influence. So he has very little connections to the levers of power and to people and groups that could lend him their support. He doesn't know them. They don't know him.
Peru's Congress is unicameral. It has only one chamber with 130 members representing the country's 32 million people. Castillo's party is not just in the minority, Barrenechea says. It's also divided.
The question to me for the first few months or weeks maybe is what will Castillo decide regarding the leader of his party, Vladimir Cerrón?
Vladimir Cerrón is an avowed Marxist-Leninist. Barrenechea says Castillo has sought to distance himself from Cerrón, but not too much. Jorge Luis Salazar Soplapuco is a political science professor at the National University in Castillo's home province of Cajamarca.
I teach international law, constitutional law, and tax law.
Salazar Soplapuco agrees the opposition in Congress will restrain Castillo's biggest ambitions.
Sí es posible. Sin embargo, esa posibilidad pasa porque el presidente pueda bajar sus
Salazar Soplapuco says Castillo needs to lower his expectations. His party may not be able to rewrite the constitution, but they might be able to implement some tax reform.
Yo creo que se puede cambiar si el Congreso modifica esa parte de la Constitución.
Salazar Soplapuco explains that, for example, raising taxes on extractive industries like mining isn't possible under Peru's constitution. Castillo has promised to do so, to spend more on education and health. Salazar Soplapuco says perhaps Castillo's party in Congress could instead pass a reform on that part of the constitution. And yet, Castillo's biggest challenge may be just staying in office altogether.
La vacancia presidencial es una medida que tiene hondo contenido político.
Salazar Soplapuco explains that removing the president from office has become a political tool that Congress uses like a nuclear weapon. And they used it in the last presidential term. Four different people held the office in 5 years. The first three were accused of corruption. For the World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
This week, a manufacturing plant in South Africa is shipping its first doses of coronavirus vaccines across the continent. This is an important development. Until now, Africa had been importing its COVID shots. As The World's Alana Gordon reports, a manufacturer has a very tall order to fill.
The numbers are stark. Globally, more than 3 billion COVID-19 vaccines have been administered. 1% or less of those are in Africa. At the start of this year, the hope was in COVAX, the main WHO initiative to distribute vaccines equitably around the globe. In February, the first shipment of vaccines, made in India, arrived at the international airport in Ghana's capital. Within a few days, Phoenix Azian, a nurse in Côte d'Ivoire, was one of the first in Africa to receive a vaccine. Public health begins with us, he told cameras. But fast forward to today, that effort has fallen woefully behind. Strive Masiyiwa is the Africa Union's special envoy on COVID-19. At a recent news conference, he said he could see the problems developing early on.
The countries that had production, whether it was India, the United States, Europe, Japan, they all restricted shipments.
Countries that produce vaccines control them and have prioritized the shots for themselves. He and other leaders got to work on trying to improve access and build up manufacturing capacity in Africa.
When African countries came together, we had all the finance ministers, all the health ministers, and we said we will buy vaccines, and we will buy them with our own money.
Across the continent, only a handful of manufacturers have experience making vaccines. They turned to Aspen Pharmacare, based on the Eastern Cape of South Africa. Last year, it reached a deal with Johnson & Johnson to help manufacture its COVID-19 vaccine. In an agreement worth $2 billion, the Africa Union has pre-ordered 400 million doses, enough to cover 30% of the population in Africa. This week, the first shipments finally went out from the plant.
Really, the good news from my side is this. We expect that by the end of August, 45 countries will have completed their first shipments.
To the north in Uganda, Peter Weiswa welcomed the news. He's a professor of public health and a member of the National Vaccine Advisory Group. Weiswa has lost family members to COVID, and many are waiting to be fully vaccinated.
My mom is waiting for a second dose. My wife is waiting for a second dose. But we don't have any information of where to go. And myself, I should be knowing. But the point is, we don't have vaccines.
He says the single-dose shot from Johnson & Johnson will also be a game-changer in the country's more rural areas. This doesn't make Africa completely self-sufficient yet. Aspen doesn't make these shots from scratch. It has to order the vaccine materials and then does something called fill and finish. This is not lost on Dr. Angelique Cotier, a family doctor in Pretoria who's treated hundreds of COVID-19 patients.
Sorry for this. Just quickly want to sign this prescription.
Cotier is the national chair of the South Africa Medical Association. She says it was only a couple months ago that contamination at a Johnson & Johnson plant in Maryland caused delays.
If we had done this right from the beginning, the whole process being manufactured in South Africa, hopefully this would not have happened.
She says having the ability to make vaccines from start to finish would give South Africa and the rest of the continent more control over manufacturing and distribution. As it stands, the Africa Union expects it will take about a year for Aspen to fill their order for 400 million COVID-19 doses, if they get enough supplies. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
The island nation of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean continues to suffer from its worst drought in four decades. The lack of rain in southern Madagascar has led to crop failure and mass hunger. The UN's World Food Program says more than a million people don't have enough food, and tens of thousands are on the brink of starvation. Joining me to discuss the situation is Shelley Thackrell, the World Food Program. Last week, you wrapped up a month-long trip, Shelley, to the most impacted reaches of Madagascar. Tell us what you saw.
Marco, it's incredible. Logistically, quite a treacherous journey to even get to the south. I started my journey on a Sunday, and I actually reached the south 4 days later. These are roads that are fairly impassable. Sort of imagine driving over rocks for 7 to 8 hours. Then I'm driving across bridges. Normally you would see flowing rivers, gushing streams. This is cracked sand, earth, gusts of winds, almost Sahelian type sandstorms that are sweeping across land which would normally be, you'd be cultivating rice or maize, is just cracked and empty.
What were people actually eating then when you were there?
Apart from the rations that we give them, often they're just foraging, eating whatever they can find. That is plants, that is leaves, that is this red cactus fruit. It's what we call survival coping mechanisms. There's a word in Malagasy called kere. Kere means empty stomach. Children who we met at some of the treatment centres for severe acute malnutrition, children who you would look at and you would think they were tiny toddlers, but they are probably 5 or 6 years old because poor nourishment, underdevelopment obviously affects a child's growth. When you sit in the centres, it's just silence. You know, there's no energy for children to laugh, to speak. I met one brother and sister whose mother was in the field. I asked both the little boy and the little girl, his sister, what their names were. They barely could lift their eyes to look at me. And it was so sad to see tiny, tiny children whose childhood has just been almost stolen from them.
The root causes of food insecurity can be pretty complex, often political, economic, and climatic factors. But the World Food Program has stated that in the case of Madagascar, climate change is the number one driving force. Explain that. Why is that believed to be so?
In southern Madagascar, Marco, it's absolutely apparent because of no rain. And whenever it does rain, it's never enough rain. It's not the right sort of rain. Sandstorms have swept across and destroyed the land where you would normally be harvesting. This community of people, 1.3 million people who are food insecure, they've done nothing to contribute to climate change. They don't burn fossil fuels, and yet they are living on the front line of what is a deteriorating situation.
So what kind of solutions is the World Food Program proposing in the short and long term? And where is the government of Madagascar in all of this?
So we are working closely with the government of Madagascar, and, you know, they will probably say the same as well, that its resources, its attention, its awareness. The World Food Program, we've been asking for $78.6 million to help get people out of this desperate situation. We are looking at other ways where we can help farmers who've lost their land to work in other means, or give micro-insurance, or give some assistance.
We first looked into the famine in southern Madagascar in March when the alarms were first sounding. Has the situation plateaued since then, or is it still getting worse?
It's getting worse, Marco, because it's not getting better. So we are still really worried that the numbers will increase. And as we look now to the next harvest season, what we need to do is to be able to provide emergency food assistance. We're in humanitarian mode. We're in emergency mode right now. Since last September, since March of this year, I predict a rather sad prediction that even in a month's time, you know, we still may be saying the same thing, worryingly, if we don't get the money that we desperately need.
Shelley Thackrell with the World Food Program speaking with us today from Johannesburg, South Africa. Shelley, thank you very much for explaining what you saw.
Thank you, Malcolm.
At the Olympics in Tokyo, synchronized diving is on display. In China, a very different kind of diving has been gaining popularity. The World's Rebecca Canther recently stopped by a diving pool in Shanghai to give it a try.
Here at an indoor pool in Shanghai, Christina Bao, a music teacher, is learning how to swim like a mermaid. Her teacher gives her tips on how to move her body through the water. Bao says the appeal is simple.
May. Sexy.
No one can resist a bikini top and a long fishtail, she says. The first time I saw it, I thought to myself, I must become a mermaid. That was on a vacation she took in Indonesia several years ago. I was so envious, she says. Everyone was diving, and all I could do was wear a life vest. I wanted to be like them and feel comfortable in the water, not just watch others. In Chinese, mermaid translates to human fish, and the term can be used for all genders. Instructor Rachel Wong says so far, her students have mostly been women who want to post mermaid photos onto their social media feeds. The classes include a photo shoot with a wide range of mermaid tails to try on. Learning mermaid diving is really about looking beautiful and taking glamour shots, she says. It's about toning your body and showing off your curves. But there's more to it than the novelty, says diving instructor Lulu Yang. There are health benefits too, she says, especially for postpartum recovery and for people who work long hours in front of a computer.
Actually, the whole body has to get into the movement. So it's very good for recover. The muscles and the body shape keep thinness. When you're under the water, the buoyancy will flow your muscle. It's very good for relaxation.
Even though she was already an accomplished diver, she says learning to be a mermaid requires a whole different skill set. It was hard at first.
I start to slow myself down and to get to know how to use my body muscle to control the movement, to make it very elegant, very slow, and very joyful.
I want to experience it myself, so I put on a monofin and slide into the water. Young gives me some tips.
Yes, can you feel it?
Yes,
can you feel it?
After an hour trying, mostly unsuccessfully, to move my body gracefully, she pronounces me not a natural.
Down, up.
Chen Mengke has waist-length bubblegum pink hair and a pink two-piece suit. Like me, she started out afraid of water. At first, I was a bit worried about my feet being stuck together in a monofin, she says. But then I realized that since I still don't know how to swim, it's actually not so strange for me not to be able to kick my legs. Now she's training for her mermaid instructor license, so she can help others get over their fears. It's not just about beauty, she says. People who get into mermaiding are athletic and like to challenge themselves. Lulu Yang, the diving instructor, says the pandemic and the related travel restrictions have only increased the interest in the sport. Without being able to travel to exotic locations to scuba dive, for example, people are turning to diving activities closer to home. One student at the diving center, Wang Xiaoxue, had another motivation to learn how to mermaid. I love ocean animals and I want to follow them, she says. I think in a past life I was a fish, and I want to return to the ocean and be a fish again. That's why I keep training. Instructors say that idea, that humans should respect underwater animals and their environment, is what they hope these new mermaids will take away with them. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
We've got photos from a Chinese mermaid training center, no gills needed. That's at theworld.org. The Kremlin is doubling down on its suppression of all things associated with Alexei Navalny. The opposition politician is already in jail after surviving a poisoning attempt. Now Moscow has blocked nearly 50 websites that he's connected to. The government said the websites promoted propaganda and banned extremist activity. Joining us now from Moscow is Alexei Kovalyov. He's an investigative editor at Medusa, a Russian language news outlet. Alexei, first of all, remind us of the current status of Alexei Navalny's political organization.
Well, for all intents and purposes, as of this June, Alexei Navalny and his organization are illegal. It's now an illegal extremist organization. So any contact and engagement with it carries significant legal consequences, but also extra legal. So even if you're not donating to the Anti-Corruption Foundation and all of its associated grassroots organizations, even if you're just expressing support to it, if you are a career politician, your career is over. So you're not running for office ever again. And the Kremlin has a lot of tools at its disposal to bar you from ever running or engaging in politics again. So that's where we are. So anything to do with Alexei Navalny is now off limits. And that also retroactively disenfranchises hundreds of thousands of people who have ever communicated or engaged with Navalny's organization in any way in the past years.
So to say the least, Navalny's organization is already in a difficult place, essentially frozen. Why would the Kremlin take the further step and shut down the organization's websites?
Well, because they can. It's a process, not a result. They want to not just bar Navalny and anyone, however tangentially connected to him, from engaging in Russian politics in any way, but they also want to erase any trace of their existence. That's how it works. This machine doesn't stop somewhere. It's just, it keeps rolling.
I mean, erase their existence. I mean, we should remember, as I said, Navalny is in prison. A lot of his allies are also in prison or in exile. I mean, what's the Kremlin's motivation behind all this censorship and political crackdown? Same answer, because they can.
And also because they see Navalny as an existential threat to their existence. So they will not stop at anything. I mean, we've already passed the chemical warfare stage. So at this point, blocking websites seems pretty mild.
I mean, it's also interesting the language the Kremlin uses, the legal language. Navalny's organization has been labeled an extremist organization by the state. Other groups and individuals have been labeled foreign agents. Explain these terms for us and what effect they actually have.
Well, it's pretty easy for me because Medusa, my organization, is also a foreign agent now.
Right.
So it's pretty mild compared to what's happening to Navalny and his people. So it's kind of a first stage in erasing you. If you're declared a foreign agent, it's pretty much a self-inflicted death by a thousand cuts because it's not the Kremlin who bans you or poisons you or, you know, erases you from existence. You have to do that yourself because there is a significant bureaucratic burden on you if you're a foreign agent. You're not illegal per se, but you have to file these very intimidating quarterly reports to the Ministry of Justice. And also other effects of these designations is that if you're a media organization, your sources will be afraid to talk to you.
Mm. Well, as you said, Alexei, I mean, this is not theoretical. Your organization, Medusa, has been labeled a foreign agent. How has that affected Medusa and your own work?
First of all, if you're a for-profit media organization like Medusa, we are a media business. We make money on ads. So this foreign agent law requires you to put this massive, ugly legal disclaimer on top of everything you publish. And that includes your social media and also your promotional materials. And as you can imagine, not many advertisers are prepared to see this massive legal disclaimer declaring that this information is published by an organization declared a foreign agent on top of every piece of sponsored content on Medusa. So the immediate effect was that 90% of our advertisers fled and our business model was ruined. We had to self-inflict massive cuts all across the board. We had to lay off people. We had to get rid of offices. And it just increases our workload and puts a huge bureaucratic pressure on us, which prevents us from doing actual journalistic work. And it just makes our life significantly difficult.
Yeah. Well, these labels are existential, as you said. You've worked abroad, Alexei. You know about the relative freedom journalists have in places other than Russia. Now you're based in Moscow. You still work in independent journalism. Did you ever think that Russia would return to a place where terms like extremist organization and foreign agent are so common? Or was that always a concern for you?
I don't think the word return applies here because I don't think we've ever been in a situation like this. Not even in the Soviet times, which had its own problems, but I don't think the term foreign agent, which would be applied so broadly to hundreds of thousands of people and so many organizations, even existed in the Soviet Union. So yeah, it's pretty unprecedented. We are in uncharted waters.
Where does this leave you and your work then, if essentially you cannot work?
Well, we still can work, because we haven't yet, and hopefully never will, been designated as an undesirable organization like another investigative outfit, Proyekt, which makes them just simply illegal, which makes any collaboration with them an illegal act. We're not yet there. The foreign agent designation just makes our work significantly harder, and it's designed to be so. So it's designed to hamper our work in a very petty and vindictive bureaucratic way. But we can still work. We don't know how long it's going to last. But I'm going to stick around to see him.
Alexei Kovalyov is an investigative editor at Medusa, a Russian language news outlet, speaking with us about the Kremlin's most recent crackdown on Russian independent media and politics. Alexei, good luck. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Finally today, a little over 2 weeks ago, videos on social media showed the streets of cities in Cuba filled with protesters. Then suddenly, the video stopped. The Cuban government shut down the internet there. One communications link, though, remained open. Amateur radio hobbyists in Cuba were sharing news with other hobbyists across the water in Florida. Then the frequencies they were using were blocked. A radio operator near Miami, W7HU Alex, sounded the alert.
Okay, guys, this is W7 Hotel United. In this moment, I want to show you how the Cuban government is interfering and scamming the 40-meter band.
Okay, the 40-meter band is a set of radio frequencies that amateurs, if you're of a certain age, you know they're called ham radio operators. Those are frequencies the ham radio operators can use for short-range communication, like from Cuba to South Florida. W7HU Alex, his full name is Alex Valladares, showed what a block signal sounds like in this YouTube video.
I'm going to show you how that sounds.
That is the sound of Cuban ham operators being blocked. Radio operators were able to establish that the jamming signals were coming from powerful transmitters in Cuba. It can't yet be proven that the Cuban government is responsible, but no one else in Cuba has towers capable of jamming radio frequencies. What we do know, short-range transmissions still are not getting across the Florida Straits. Well, our radio signal is not being blocked, thank goodness. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're back with you tomorrow.